Today we have a disagreement on American power and the role that the United States should be playing in the world. To have this conversation, we've brought together two experts with very different perspectives.
A perception of American strength is a deterrent, and it makes aggressive powers like China and Russia less likely to act impetuously.
Shadi Hamid is an American author and political scientist who is currently a columnist and member of the editorial board at The Washington Post. Previously, he was a longtime senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. He is also a host on the Wisdom of Crowds podcast.
It's an incredible American arrogance, incredible arrogance, to speak on behalf of the world.
Daniel Bessner is the Annette H. and Kenneth B. Pyle Associate Professor in American Foreign Policy at the University of Washington. He also co-hosts the American Prestige podcast. Recently, he was personally sanctioned by the Russian government for unspecified reasons, which is a real badge of honor. Welcome to The Disagreement. I'm your host, Alex Grodd. Each week, two experts come together for a long-form, productive conversation about the world's most controversial issues. Today, we ask a wide range of important questions about American power. What is the current state of American power? To what extent should the U.S. be involved in Ukraine, Taiwan, and the Middle East? Are we the good guys? And what are the alternatives to American hegemony? This conversation is a sequel to an extended disagreement between Shadi and Danny on the Wisdom of Crowds podcast 2 years ago. We'll link to it in the show notes. It's definitely worth a listen. So now, take a deep breath, open your mind as far as it's willing to go, and prepare for a different kind of conversation on American power. Daniel and Shadi, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
We're going to run back a conversation that the two of you had almost 2 years ago on American power and foreign policy. And I'm very excited because that original conversation was a tour de force and incredibly spirited and quite rigorous. So I'm excited to have the updated version today. So with that, Shadi, 2 years ago, I got two quotes from you from that conversation and would love your updated thoughts. You said American power on balance is better than the alternative. So not a ringing endorsement, but an endorsement nonetheless. And you also said, I do think we have a moral interest to help places become more democratic and less authoritarian. So would love to see where you're at in the spring of 2024.
So I still stand by that statement that America, on balance, has been or is a force for good, I think. So it's not as strong as it was 2 years ago. A lot has happened in the interim period. And for me, most notably, the war in Gaza, which has made me question some of my commitments and prior assumptions. Like the way that I feel now and the kind of outrage that I feel around the Biden administration's policy to Gaza and our role in what is really, a mass killing of Palestinians on a remarkable and shocking level. That's the moment that I'm in now. But, you know, what I said, 2 years ago in that Wisdom of Crowds debate with Danny is that it's better than the alternatives. And I think this part of it is really important, that we don't live in an ideal world where we can have a perfect empire or neo-imperial force or superpower. We have to actually consider the available options in front of us. And while America, kind of sucks in a lot of ways in absolute terms, but when we look at it in relative terms compared to the other options, America starts to look significantly better. And here I have in mind China, first and foremost, also Russia, if we want to consider Russia a great power. I don't really think it is, but let's say we considered it in that way. And then there's really no one else to consider. I still very much believe that the U.S. should use its unprecedented power to promote the things that we as Americans believe in. And I think we've done a terrible job of that. So I'm actually someone who's very critical of the U.S. foreign policy record. We have propped up to the tune of billions of dollars across the region, some of the most brutal regimes in the world. And that is something that I've been an outspoken and consistent critic of. But the thing that I want to do about that is not to just give up on America. I want us to be better because I think we can. I don't think there's any reason that the U.S. has to continue supporting brutal Arab autocratic regimes. That's actually contrary to not only our values, but our interests as well. It hasn't—
Sorry, I got to step in. Who is we as Americans? And I don't know why you would think America actually promotes democracy when it doesn't do that at home, even slightly.
To clarify that point, are you saying that we don't have democratic institutions at home, so how can we promote them abroad?
Well, who is Shadi? Shadi says we as Americans. Who's he speaking about? The people who vote for Trump or the people who vote for Biden or me or you? One. Two, there's just no way you could honestly look at how the U.S. state makes decisions and say this is a democracy, however you want to define that term.
I mean, there is. I mean—
There's votes.
I'm comfortable
there's
saying
very
that
limited
America,
procedural democracy.
I mean, I did write a book.
So did I. I wrote a whole book about it too.
No. But you can't say, Danny, that I can't. I literally did say it. I say it all the time.
No,
I say
people
it on
say
a regular,
it, but it's just like an incredibly restricted, narrow definition of democracy that took off in the 1930s for peculiar historical circumstances. It's not a substantive
let's
definition.
Let's drill into it. Let's just drill into it because if one of Shadi's key points is promoting democracy.
Sure. So there are types of democracies. There's economic democracy, there's social democracy, there's cultural democracy, and there's political democracy, usually identified similarly with something called procedural democracy, which is that we have democratic procedures like voting. The project of the United States, and particularly the U.S. state since 1945, has been to delimit the areas in which the public is able to influence policy decisions and political decisions. So you could, I agree, the United States is a procedural democracy. We have free and fair elections. I will admit to that, but that is a very restricted, narrow definition of democracy, which is one of the reasons why this whole like democracy promotion thing was always bullshit, because it basically meant bringing voting to other countries, which is not a substantive definition of democracy, which is why one of the reasons there's been this populist upsurge. Moreover, just to bring in a little bit of Marx here, I think there's a real argument to be made that the capitalist economy actually functions outside of human will at this point, which is precisely what Marx said would happen, that it would become so complex, it would become so global that there are actually no points within it where you're able to exert human agency. So I just think that democracy is used in plain speak to refer to something that is actually not in any substantive way true.
So democracy is one part of it. I think broader liberalism, freedom of speech and the freedom of assembly and freedom of the press and things like that. Have democracies that are sort of up to snuff for you ever existed outside of theoretical Marxism?
No, of course not.
So outside of theoretical Marxist democratic institution that might exist or might not ever, do you see a spectrum of sort of democratic institutions are just institutions in general from not great, but okay to horrific?
Yeah, obviously North Korea is not the United States.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Saudi Arabia is not the United States.
Right.
Of course.
So if Shadi, just to bring it back to you and your concept of spreading democracy, Danny has an issue with all existing forms of, you know, government and society right now, but he acknowledged there is a spectrum between North Korea on one end and then perhaps European socialism on the other, or, you know, and Danny can clarify this. So I think what you're trying to do and promote, while Danny's never going to be on board with promoting democracy, I think another way to frame it is you think the U.S. could be promoting the higher end of that spectrum, the more ethical end of what exists within liberalism.
Can I just clarify my position? I came to my position through reason. You know, like most Americans, I initially believed that the United States could do positive things abroad, but the historical record is not ambiguous. How do you account for the actual history of the entirety of U.S. westward expansion from the beginning to the expansion to the wider Western Hemisphere, to the global expansion, blah, blah, blah? You have to actually deal with that in a serious way. and not just wave it away and say, we'll do better in the future. That is not enough. That is not enough for me.
Okay, so I also agree that the historical record is unambiguous, that the U.S. has on balance been a force for good. So I don't share your premise. I mean, if we're and here I'm thinking primarily about, you know, post-war. I mean, and of course, the World War II.
It's been good if you're the Imperial Corps in the North Atlantic, which I think you could even say is like one broad polity. Let's say from Germany westward, you could define World War I and World War II as like a civil war within that polity. Yes, it is good if you're in Western Europe. It is bad if you're anywhere else.
Okay. So a couple things here. So I acknowledge that, again, in the developing world, in any number of Latin American countries, as we both know, and elsewhere too, that during the Cold War, because of the fight against the Soviet Union, we end up supporting horrible right-wing dictators in the name of
the U.S. invaded Central American and Latin American countries in the teens and 20s. It's not only a Cold War thing, and there's indigenous genocide.
Okay,
as well.
But here I'm talking about the Cold War period. Danny, so just let me just be able to lay out, and then, you know.
Hey, it's called the disagreement, not the agreement. No, for sure, man, go.
So, but starting in the 1980s, the U.S. started to put pressure on these right-wing dictators in Latin America and East Asia and places like, you know, South Korea, the Philippines, Brazil, Chile, Guatemala, you name it, that there started to be a shift. It wasn't perfect, but there was a movement in a better direction. In the 1990s, we did support democratization in Eastern Europe, so not just west of Germany. Let's not also forget that Japan is a democracy, in part because of the role of the U.S.
It's a pretty sanguine interpretation of what the U.S. did in Eastern Europe and Russia. I just want to point that out.
So at this moment in time, we're close to the all-time record high in the number of democracies in the world in total. So
defined by Freedom House, how?
It hovers at around, the all-time high was 53%.
I mean, Freedom House is not a very reliable source.
No, this is also VDEM.
I mean, this is...
but I don't know them, but they're also not reliable.
If you look back from your conversation 2 years ago, the exact, I mean, it was literally the exact...
I mean, these are nonsense metrics. I mean, this is why I'm not a political scientist.
But I am a political scientist, and we actually study this stuff. So, I mean, look, I have no gripe against historians, like, as a category of people. But I'm sorry, like, we actually study democracy. We use metrics. We try to measure these things. You can't just come in here and say, well, democracy doesn't exist.
I mean, well, I would say as a historian who studies the history of political science, I would say there's so many ontological problems with the very project of trying to metric out democracy, it's essentially useless.
Okay. But while these measures are imperfect, the fact that most if not all of the democracy indexes that I'm aware of show that the number of democracies out of the total number of countries in the world is close to the highest it's ever been. And if you look at, say, right after World War II, if I recall, according to VDEM, it was somewhere around 7% of countries were considered, you know, full democracies or something like that. Clearly, there has been some positive movement over time, and the U.S. has played some role.
I just
in
don't
that.
Think
Not
that
everywhere. Okay.
But just the evidence doesn't suggest that. Who's defining democracy? What does democracy mean? How are you coming? You know, like these
right,
are
right. But
these are look, these are occluding statistics that people point to, and if you don't actually dig into them, they do not prove.
Okay,
anything.
But all I'm just look. The point here, Danny, is that there's a general. You can disagree on how good or like. Am I overstating things? You might think so, but the movement, the trend line. Is clear. There are now more democracies by far than there were in 1940 or 1945. So that is a good thing. And it has coincided with a period post 1945 when the US was ascendant. And the number of democracies increased significantly post-Cold War. So when America became the sole superpower, we see an uptick in democratization. Why? Because it's not a coincidence that when America is the sole superpower, America is a democracy, a procedural democracy. And that is going to have demonstration effects and diffusion effects in the rest of the world, because there is no longer a communist dictatorship that is challenging American power. So this is what happened.
Let's get to Ukraine, because I think this is a good tangible example of U.S. interventionism and the various ethics around it. So either of you can take this jump ball. What caused Putin to invade Ukraine? What are the root causes of the invasion? And then we can jump off from there.
Chadi, you want to start? You could go first. And I won't interrupt you, I promise.
No. Danny, how about, I'll defer to you on this. Well, I won't. I mean, I'll let you go first.
Sure. One, it's impossible to know, truly. So we're making a lot of broad inferential leaps when we're trying to determine why any one leader does a specific thing. It's very difficult to know in hindsight when you have full documentation available, and it's basically impossible to know now. I can't read into Putin's soul. I can't look into Putin's soul, rather. I think it's probably a concatenation of factors. Obviously, personal factors, psychological factors of who he was. It came at the end of a period, from my understanding, of a long COVID isolation for Putin, that he wasn't speaking to many people. That probably didn't do wonders for his psychology or rational analysis. I think that there's certainly, as he said it enough that you have to believe it, there's this sense of historical mission going back to, referencing Kiev Rus and these pre-modern Russian empires, and certainly some level of him, he probably just believes that Ukraine is part of this natural Russian territory dating back centuries, and that this is an imperial space that you need to belong to.
Can you, just for listeners, unpack what Kiev Rus, or the city, the importance of Kiev Rus?
It's a pre-modern empire in which my understanding, I took a history of modern Ukraine in college, but my understanding is that there was a series of pre-modern empires in Eastern Europe. There's a Lithuanian Polish empire, there's a Kievan Rus empire, and so this is like, obviously we don't know it here, we don't know this history, but there's these long medieval histories that Putin, I imagine, says, basically say Ukraine and Russia are the same country. He doesn't give a shit what happened in the 20th century, that, Khrushchev gave X or Y to Z or Q, but that these are essentially the same territory and fuck the West. He definitely, I think, certainly believes that. I think he was very clearly concerned about what he considered to be encroachments on what Putin again considers to be Russia's sphere of influence in terms of the EU and NATO. I think that's pretty obvious.
Those are the big two, right? The big two are just imperialism and...
Well, I think the big three are psychology, the sort of cultural historical memory, and a genuine fear of security encroachment in what he considers to be Russia's sphere of influence.
Shadi, would you weight those in a particular way?
I actually don't strongly disagree with anything Danny said. I mean, I'm guessing that we maybe disagree on the implications of some of those facts and what they mean for the U.S., but... Putin is someone who has expansionist ambitions. He's had them for quite some time. I thought Danny was going to say more about the fact of NATO enlargement was, putting that we were too aggressive as, Americans in the West, and we were threatening Putin in a way that was overly provocative, and that it was understandable that Putin would get a little bit jittery and then do something.
The Mearsheimer.
The Mearsheimer argument. I'm glad that...
I mean, yeah, this was easily predictable. It's not the only reason why he did it.
I'm glad that's not what Danny is suggesting here, so I don't have to argue against that position, which I think
I'm extremely sophisticated.
clearly.
So nuanced.
But so I'll add something. I think that Putin sensed American weakness, because in previous rounds of conflict and aggression where Putin tried to take over a territory, whether in Georgia in 2008 or in Crimea in 2014, the U.S. talked a big game, but then didn't really do much in response and backed down, and we let Putin get away with it. Whenever Putin tested American and Western resolve, because we didn't want to be overly confrontational, we stepped back. So these are various examples of I think a growing perception that America was not willing to, you know, put its money where its mouth was, to use a kind of capitalist expression. So I think there has been a sense that the U.S. is in decline. The U.S. doesn't have the courage of its convictions. The U.S. is tired. The U.S. is internally polarized and consumed with its own affairs. So if there's a time to strike is now. And I would like us to be stronger for precisely this reason, because I think that a perception of American strength is a deterrent, and it makes aggressive powers like China and Russia less likely to act impetuously. And I'll also just add, I think these are, I hesitate to use this word, I don't use it often in the context of international affairs. I believe that Russia and China are evil in some kind of almost deeper metaphysical sense. Like, these are regimes that cannot be tolerated because they speak to the worst of human experience. I mean, you know, for all of our faults as Americans, I don't think the American regime, if you will, or the American government is evil, because I don't think it can be evil, because it's a representation of 300 and however imperfect that representativeness might be, we actually have some say. It might be a limited say, but we have some say in our government. And that's why I believe that we need a counter. We need someone to make sure that these regimes don't rise, that they don't become more powerful, and America is the only option to stem that rise.
Shadi, I have a quick question. I just reject the whole framing of evil, so let's just put that to the side. I think that's not a useful way to understand the world or international relations, so off to the side. What do you say about the fact that study after study shows that the American public has almost no say on policy or politics, and it's a ruling clique of elites? If that's your criterion for defining good versus evil, how do you respond to those studies?
Well, I mean, but of course, in a country of 330 million, elites are going to have a disproportionate share of power. I mean, no one's talking about direct democracy here.
Okay, so you excuse it. Okay.
You might have an idea of direct democracy where all of us are—
Even direct democracy. Just like when you vote for someone in a local election and then they're totally captured by lobbying interests. I'm not even saying we could have a representative. Let's just say we have the representative democracy.
In a local election, like the Somerville city councilor is captured by lobbying interests?
Yeah. Have you seen The Wire? Yeah, of course. Those places are all captured by like real estate interests, landlord interests, lobbying interests. Yeah, it happens locally. It happens nationally.
Like I grew up in a 12,000 person suburban town with, you know, an active school board or whatever. I think there is, again, like a generalization or universalization of the corruption that doesn't make sense. I think at local levels.
I think it's true. I mean, there's probably a low enough level where it's inconsequential enough where there's no capture. But I mean, this is what happens in this is what the founding fathers worried about.
Okay, but
precisely.
Of course, there are real estate interests in local contexts. I mean, democracy allows different interests to express their preferences policy-wise. Like, I don't see how that's inherently nefarious.
Let's take a specific example. There was the recent writer strike in Hollywood, right? So the WGA in 2023, I believe these numbers are correct, spent or was able to spend something like $300,000 on lobbying. How much do you think Disney, Comcast, Paramount, Netflix, et cetera, were able to spend on lobbying? Do you think this is an equal fight? Do you think that doesn't have
the writers got most of what they
media
wanted?
Policy?
The writers had a lot of leverage. And got
I'm writing a piece about
wanted.
No, they didn't.
They got a lot of wrong. What they wanted.
That is not correct. Look, I literally, this is, we'll I'm writing a very big piece based on dozens of interviews and lots
okay,
of research.
We can bracket that. We'll bracket that because I have a vague recollection. But
Danny, you're not, okay, let me just say, like, you're not,
sure.
it's not necessarily true that you're right about everything. I know, like, you're
well,
obviously,
that's
like,
the big disagreement here.
You're obviously really smart, but you have to,
thank
like,
you.
Leave some room for the fact that other people have different starting premises, that not everyone agrees. Like, some of your arguments are ideologically oriented, to put it mildly. That's fine. You have an ideology.
Yeah, so does everyone. Yeah, it's a framework, of course.
Has it not occurred to you that your ideology might distort some of your analysis?
Of course it might, but it just hasn't.
I have a way of maybe asking this, because I think at a certain point, if Russia, China, America are all baddies and there's no distinction worth drawing, then it's a hard, this entire foreign policy conversation is difficult. I mean,
it's where you're situated, right? Like I'm an American, right? Like we still live in a world of nation states, and I am ultimately have to be organized toward what the United States does abroad. And that leads me to arrive at some definition of broad American interest, because I think you need that as a starting point before you start declaiming on U.S. foreign policy. So I agree.
That's fine. But I think if you – so you put North Korea and America on a spectrum in different places. Like where would you put Russia? Where would you put China? Where would you put Iran? Is there any – is it pure relativism outside of North Korea?
I mean, to be frank, I don't think either of us know enough about the governance structures of those two states.
Wait, are you serious?
I mean, I would really, to make like a claim like that, do you know how China and Russia actually function? Are you an anthropologist of either? All I know is that whenever I think, whenever I think I know about how a country actually functions, and I talk to an area studies specialist, they're like, it's a way more complicated and you're flattening a lot.
But you're flattening the U.S. experience, but right when we start talking about Russia and China, it's like, oh, we don't know. We don't really have scholarship. Actually, there's like the endless number of books that go into how the Chinese Communist Party operates. We don't have perfect visibility into it, but I think we have broad outlines of how the Chinese government operates.
Before I started identifying either as evil, I feel like I would have to do a lot of investigation. I mean, that's just like what I'm comfortable with.
Okay, forget about evil. That was just like a rhetorical thing, in part because I was curious how you would respond to the word. But putting aside evil, which is obviously like a certain way of speaking, like I think all I would really want to put to you here is I would like to think and hope to think that you can say the U.S. in terms of its government and society, let's say government, let's just stick to that, is preferable to Russia and China's for the simple reason. I mean, I think it's so obvious, I'd almost feel silly.
So that's what I'm inclined to say, but let me pose this to you, right? I'm inclined to say that as an American.
Okay, great. So then if that's the case, and those are our competitors.
But whenever I talk to someone who studies Russia, they're like, everyone hates Gorbachev and Yeltsin and they love Putin, right? So that doesn't come from nowhere. Right. So this is why I'm uncomfortable making statements like that, because why does that happen? Why did they view what happened in the 1990s so negatively? Why is there this nostalgia for a Stalin or a Putin? Right. So like, of course, as an American, I'm inclined to say, yes, I prefer American institutions because at least they're procedurally democratic. But then you see like these social facts that seem to point in a different direction than where I would want to go. That's my basic point. Right.
Okay. But if you're acknowledging that the U.S. is preferable, and so then we have these options on the world stage of potential or aspiring hegemons. Options. So if you're saying the U.S. is preferable relative to Russia and China, so that would seem to suggest that we should want the U.S. to maintain its edge over those two countries.
Well, I don't think China or Russia has global ambitions like you apparently do. I think China wants to dominate the Eastern Hemisphere 100%, particularly East Asia, more so than the Eastern Hemisphere. I think they'll have a very hard time with India. And I think Russia wants to have basic, you know, the equivalent of what the United States has in the Caribbean and Latin America, which is to be its total dominant sphere of influence in Eastern Europe. That's what I think. I don't think they want to be global.
Let's get back to Ukraine. So stick with the Russia point, because that's obviously fundamental to the strategy in the war, is Russia's, whether there are ambitions beyond Ukraine. And so do you think Putin will stop at Ukraine, or do you think he has broader ambitions in Eastern Europe?
I'll ask him next time I talk on the phone. I have no idea.
Well, okay, Chadi.
Okay, that seems like a bit of a cop-out. Like now you have
If I
no
had to
idea?
Guess, no. I don't think Putin's going to march into Poland or the Baltics. If I had to guess, no. But again, I didn't think he would invade Ukraine. I can't read his mind. I don't know.
Which would suggest that it's plausible that he has broader ambitions. I mean,
I think it's a difference in scale of risk. And so I think like Putin, maybe not the most rational actor, but I do think that is a qualitative difference to try to invade the Baltics or to try to invade Poland, is my guess.
I want to just dwell on the Ukraine part of this. So I think we're almost talking about Ukraine as if, oh, it's understandable. This is his natural sphere of influence. That's what he cares about, almost as if we're giving that legitimacy. That that is not...
Who cares about legitimacy? We're talking about IR. This isn't like a moral play. Like, this was like, Hans Morgenthau 101. Like, legitimacy, was it legitimate for the U.S. to invade Iraq? Is it legitimate for the U.S. to send weapons to Israel? It's just not an interesting way to approach these questions. You in moralistic territory. We're all Americans. We all know where we land on this.
But you talk in moralistic terms on a lot of other things, right? When we come
I'm an American. I'm talking about my own country. I'm not making claims about the entire world. I'm a citizen of this country. That is the fundamental ontological position that I occupy. That is where I'm doing. But Americans like to do, only since 1945, is speak on behalf of the world. Do Bolivians speak on the behalf of the world? No. Why? What's different?
Because they're not a superpower.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the problem.
That seemed like the answer.
Okay, but like, I just want to...
American arrogance. Incredible arrogance. Wait, the world.
Okay, first of all, I don't know what you mean by speak on behalf of the world exactly. Like, what are you actually talking about on behalf?
When you say legitimacy, what legitimate in terms of what structure? International law, American morality, Christian morality. What is the criterion by which you're using that term?
Well, it was illegal in terms
of international
law.
So the U.S. invaded
For starters, as someone who kind of got their start in the anti-war movement, I'm more than happy to say that that was an illegitimate war.
So international law is the criterion?
No, it's one criteria. You can't You can't just invade unprovoked sovereign nations. Ukraine is a sovereign nation.
I mean,
you can't invade them.
Counter argument, but yeah, okay.
What's the counter argument?
The U.S. does it all the fucking time.
Can you give
the U.S. had tried to overturn, the 66 regimes, invaded Iraq, illegal actions, blah, blah, blah. You know the argument, right?
But you said all the time, which suggests
dozens of times in the last 100 years is all the time. Yes.
What? Okay, that's confusing. But
no, it's not.
But okay, what Russia
the U.S.
did,
has tried to illegally overthrow regimes dozens of times.
That's not the same as invading a country militarily. That's really bad, as we've already discussed. That's different than sending in hundreds of thousands of troops to invade a country and try to occupy it. I mean, they're not the same thing.
Sure, agreed.
Shadi, so Danny had asked what the other reasons were outside of violation of international law. You had said deterrence, trying to flex American strength, which has been in decline. I mean, first question is, what is your position on Ukraine right now? Obviously, there's a spending bill that is caught up in the House. You know, there's a bit of a stalemate. Without aid from U.S., it looks like it's pretty dire for the Ukrainians. We'll start with Shadi. What is your position when it comes to Ukraine?
What's your sense of what my position is?
I mean, it seems like you see a moral imperative to support them and support the funding, support the $60 billion, 60 plus. That's my sense of it.
Yeah. So, okay. I mean, I was critical of the Biden administration for actually being slow to support the Ukrainians in terms of advanced weaponry and delayed supplies and so forth. I feel like the Biden administration took quite a bit of time to get to certain conclusions about what kind of support to give. And those are crucial months lost. I do wonder if a more, I don't want to say maximalist, because we're not talking about a maximalist approach. We're not talking about like no-fly zones per se or something that much further on the escalatory ladder. But, you know, so I always had this concern, and I think that this is what we've done sometimes in other conflicts, that we support certain parties, but not enough for them to win. And that there's almost a sense that I don't want to say we were using the Ukrainians to grind down the Russians, but sometimes I felt in certain statements that you would hear from certain senior officials that there was some of that, like, oh, let's as long as the Ukrainians want to fight, let's help them to continue fighting without necessarily thinking about what a Russian defeat would actually look like, and sometimes even being reticent to go as far as we could. So that's always my concern when the U.S. supports actors like the Ukrainians, like, are we really in it? If we're going to be in it, let's go as far as we can go and not, let's not do this like, ooh, you know, well, actually, we don't want to send these weapons. We want to be careful.
They don't want Ukraine to win. I mean, this is like, this is why I feel like this is so strange that you advocate for U.S. hegemony. I mean, I wrote a piece on this for the Alameda Institute. I just read what they say. They literally say, we just want to grind Russia down. I mean, why would you assume the U.S. would act?
Yeah, okay. Yes, but that's literally my criticism. That's, Danny, we agree on that. That's my—
No, I know, but then why would you think they should do more? It's just like they've never suggested that they could act morally.
Okay, but then that's my criticism. I think that we should have actually been in it to win and to really have more—
But that's not the U.S. interest there, right, Shadi? I mean, like, this is the whole point. Their interest is not to do that. They don't give a shit.
Who's we? I mean, the 70 senators who voted to—
The U.S. elite that makes decisions.
You know, support.
I mean, I think this is mostly a foreign policy establishment war. And it's interesting that it's being held up and it's kind of becoming a public issue. But when you look at the first year of the war— And who knows what other things are being done that the Washington Post or New York Times didn't investigate with these like little deals, like we just revealed what happened in Israel. But
he just called out your—
But yeah, I just think if you literally look at the statements,
that hurt. That was painful.
No, they did good work. They did good work. But I just think like if you look at what they literally say, they said what they wanted. They wanted to just grind Russia down.
Okay, but there's a lot of us who wanted the U.S. to do something differently. Like, you're treating that U.S. policy on Ukraine was— it was inevitable that we would have precisely this policy. There's no room for agency in your account.
I did predict this was what would happen before, in a piece written before Putin's invasion, that what has happened is precisely what was going to happen. Because again, I just use history as a guide.
But you said that you didn't anticipate Putin invading. So clearly you don't anticipate everything.
Well, I know more about the U.S., I know the U.S. is going to act.
So you can predict the U.S. Like, is that really what you're saying here? Like, you just know what the U.S.
No, because no one can predict anything. That's impossible, obviously. None of us have the God's eye viewpoint.
But you're talking about, like, there's a unified cabal. Okay.
I could assume, based on history, what would happen, and my prediction in this case happened to be right.
Okay, but you know what they say about history.
No, don't go into it as a PhD. There's no jobs.
It repeats itself?
History doesn't always repeat itself.
I thought they also say history is doomed to repeat itself.
Your boy Mark said first is tragedy, then is farce. Yeah.
Yeah, your boy.
Your boy Carl.
My boy Mark says, what is it? Men make their own history, but not in the structure of their choosing, I believe, which is broadly true. Yeah, I think that's actually a pretty fair way to understand what happens in history. That there is human agency, but there is restrictions created by structures.
Okay, the whole point of living in a democracy such as our, like, however flawed, okay, a procedural democracy, just so we don't have to get into like a definitional thing again. We live in a country where at least you and I can actually influence things to a minimal degree, but like we, along with other people, we actually have a voice, and I think one of the reasons we wake up in the morning and engage on these issues and write and debate and research is because we want our country to be better. We might disagree on what that looks like, but I think we both have, I would assume, you know, we care about our country, so on and so forth. So that means that I think it's reasonable for us to think that the U.S. can change. That the U.S. foreign policy establishment is not some constant that is unchanging throughout time that always does the bad thing.
Yeah, but you don't think that's that important. Come on. That's not that important.
To put a fine point on it, what is your vision for America, though, in terms of, I mean, in terms of restraint and retreat, Danny?
Almost a philosophical position. I believe that countries that are actually in regions are more adept at dealing with situations that are in their region. So just to say Ukraine, I think it's totally reasonable for European countries to come together and decide what they want to do vis-a-vis Putin and Ukraine. I just don't see where the United States' national interest is in that, because I don't think that the United States should be paying for the entirety of European defense, the security umbrella that Shadi pointed to, et cetera, et cetera. So I would say get rid of the bases, spend a lot less on defense, reinvest in education, reinvest in infrastructure, reinvest in the actual population here.
Now, and what does Russia, China, North Korea, Iran do when the U.S. is just like, you know, hanging out and doing their own thing across the Atlantic? Is there no, do you have no concern for expand.
Well, I think China is going to push out the U.S. Let's take them in turn. I think China is going to push out the U.S. no matter what. It is simply too powerful. The United States is not going to be able to have forward forces like it has. I argued this at length in Harper's, and in, I think it was July 2022, the exact reasons why this is inevitable. So in terms of China, I think the U.S. should foster some sort of security transition with its allies there that prevents some form of Chinese domination, even though, frankly, the realist in me says that they're going to have to come to some form of terms with China. Japan or South Korea is just, they are close to China. China is way more powerful than them. And I don't think it's in the United States or world's interest to remain forever, or I was going to say hegemonic, but I don't think they're quite hegemonic anymore, but some position of hegemony in East Asia. I think Iran has just been extraordinarily demonized by the United States. I don't think Iran is going to be some expansionist state. I think there's absolutely nothing to indicate that. So I think, I don't know precisely what will happen. That'll be for the countries in the region to figure out.
Do you think Japan and South Korea would like this idea of the U.S. withdrawing from East Asia? Like, what about them?
Yeah, probably not. They probably wouldn't love that idea. If the U.S. is providing all of their security, that's a pretty good bargain for them.
What message does that send then?
It is not, I can't speak on behalf of international humanity. Plus, I think the way that I'm arguing, what I'm arguing for will in the long term be beneficial for international humanity, and that's international relations, blah, blah, blah. When it comes to Russia, I think that's going to be up to Europe to decide what they want to do. And I imagine Europe would promote a very similar policy to the United States, in fact.
Is there any sign that Europeans can fight on their own and do proper collective defense? I mean, there seems to be no, I mean, that seems like a big gambit to think that if we just say, hey, we're done, guys, you fend for yourselves, that they'd be able to get
their
act
together.
Anyone's
really saying this is going to be like day one is this, and then on day two, it's different. It'll obviously have to be a transitional period.
Okay. Let's do it. Israel, to close on a depressing topic, but one that you both have been thinking a lot about. You know, Shadi, maybe just start at a high level, like on your progression over the last 5 months. And Danny, you can weigh in and see if there are any disagreements, and then we can, we can take it from there.
Yeah. So I've been questioning my commitments, and just to be more clear about what I mean there. I am on contract to finish a book fairly soon, and it's been delayed in part because of Gaza. That is basically making, it's more complex than this, but that America on balance is a force for good and a case for, if you will, American dominance. And I started to have doubts about whether I was comfortable writing a book with that basic thrust. And I've had to kind of reframe and revise and bring in Gaza. And sometimes I wake up and I'm like, even if I believe this is true, I don't just like, ugh. Like this has really been defining for me in a way that no foreign policy development in my adult life has been.
Do you mind my asking why?
I think that the level of destruction and killing, mass killing that Israel has inflicted on the Palestinian people is just shocking at a level that I don't even know how to process it. I actually struggle to talk about it. I mean, if we look at, and just for the sake of comparison, if we look at the number of people the U.S. military killed in the Iraq war and thereafter, according to Iraq Body Count, which does the numbers on this in a lot of detail, from 2003 to 2011, so 8 years, the U.S. was directly responsible, the U.S. military was directly responsible for 14,000 civilian deaths. Israel eclipsed that in just over 100 days. It's a remarkable, and this is also in keeping in mind that the Iraqi population is 15 times more than Gaza. So on a per capita, per day basis, what Israel has done in Gaza has no comparison in the 21st century. We'd have to go well back into, and this is like any conflict in the 21st century. So the U.S. thankfully does not do war like that anymore. We actually take care to avoid when we can't, like, not only when we can, but to really a considerable degree, at least in certain conflicts, to minimize civilian casualties and to not target like senior ISIS or Al-Qaeda commanders when we know their family is around them. Israel has no compunction about any of this and seems completely indifferent to matter. There's not even a pretense any longer. I can get Israel doing that, and that's what they're doing. What I don't get is how we are directly complicit in that. It's actually quite rare for us to be directly complicit and actually giving the weapons, giving the military provisions, the emergency supplies that allows this to unfold in real time. That's the part that as an American, I'm just like in utter like shock and awe about. I can't even get my head around it. We are directly aiding a mass killing of just incredible proportions. So that's why, how can I in good conscience tell my fellow Americans or Arabs in the Middle East or people in developing countries who have doubts about America, and I write a book about it and I say, hey, you guys should believe in us. After what they've seen, I don't know how I can look them in the eye.
Let me just ask you about one statistic, because there is a meme going around about the fact that the ratio of civilians to combatants killed in Gaza is about 2-to-1 and decreasing. And there's a meme that 2-to-1 ratio is actually quite not just like not horrible, it's quite good relative to other wars that have been waged. Like, do you have any thoughts on the fact that on this as a metric, does it even matter? Is it, you know?
Yeah. Look, so I...
How do they define combatant? Every young man?
But even if you grant it, if you grant that okay, there so are keep Hamas...
But here's the thing, I'm not going to grant something that has no evidence to support it. I haven't seen any evidence that would suggest that the 2-to-1 number is actually accurate. I mean, even Israeli spokespeople and sources give wildly varying numbers for how many Hamas fighters they think are killed at particular times. And it's just, and they don't give any evidence to support their claims. They just expect us to take it at face value. The fact that we know so many women and children have been killed suggests that the ratio isn't quite there. In previous Israel-Hamas conflicts, the ratio was about 1/3 killed were combatants. And I think that's what people might be drawing on. They're kind of extrapolating based on previous conflicts. Those were much more targeted. I mean, you know, I guess somewhat euphemistically targeted and precise wars. They weren't kind of indiscriminate, which is even a word that Biden has used, indiscriminate bombing. So I think it's fair to say that the numbers are probably lower than 1/3 this time around, because clearly Israel isn't taking as much care or really like concerning itself that much with civilian fallout. So I assume it's lower than that. We just don't know. But it's just weird to me when you see this kind of level of human suffering and destruction, like that your first instinct would be to like, oh, well, actually, let's minimize the number of people that were killed. Let's question the death tolls. That suggests to me a kind of moral failing. Like just to, like, you know what? Like when you see people being killed, just offer, just don't like get into like, oh, like all the numbers. Like, is that really like a moral response? Just say, yes, Gazans are suffering. Yes. We acknowledge that Palestinian innocents are being killed. Just show something like that.
Let me ask Danny this as an American, you know, from as an American Jew, because you used the term, I think, in your fifth column interview, like they are human, flesh and blood people, like, you know, they're and I do think that there is a real issue with empathy with what is going on there. Danny, why do you think this is? Like, what is, I mean, maybe you're seeing it, you see it differently.
I mean, it's obvious, Holocaust. Yeah, I mean, it's just like post-Holocaust jewelry. We're not that far from the Holocaust. It's still a live memory. It's that simple.
But couldn't that cut both ways? Like, for me, the memory of the Holocaust is a deeply humanistic...
Okay, Jews under 40 are a further step removed, right? But if you think about our parents' generation, their parents were usually World War II soldiers or survivors of the Holocaust. If they're Ashkenazim and not Mizrahim or some Sephardim, of course, were... as well. But I think it's that simple. Plus you get the 73 war where it looked like Israel might lose.
Jews over the age of 40, you have more direct memory of the Holocaust. Not to sound naive here, but the memory of the Holocaust was at the heart of, you know, Jewish participation in various social movements and civil rights struggles that were, you know, oriented towards securing the freedom and rights of, you know, other marginalized groups.
Yeah. Like the difference is Israel is viewed as like the refuge. That's the difference.
And this gets at like one of the reasons why this conflict has affected me so much is because I do sense that Israel-Palestine feels like it's a proxy for a deeper set of like civilizational fault lines. I do think that there is a kind of undercurrent of anti-Arab, anti-Muslim sentiment that like runs through a lot of the discourse that like Israel is this lone outpost of Western values and against those kind of like barbaric Arabs and Muslims who have never been able to adapt to modernity, them with their death cults and their, like, there's something wrong with, like, it also has echoes to the post 9/11 discourse of Muslims and Arabs being like the other upon which to define like Western values and Western civilization. So I think that makes me like really nervous as well, like the deeper implications. And I like, maybe I'm reading between the lines too much with certain people, but I'm pretty sure with some people, I'm not reading between the lines.
Shadi, you want to come to my side? Just do it already. You don't really believe in the U.S.
All right, final thing. The Steel Man. Just asking you each to take sort of swap out positions and do the, you know, Shadi, do the strongest, most good faith Danny foreign policy worldview, view on American hegemony. And Danny, you take Shadi. So it's a fun way to close.
It's certainly a way to close.
I don't know if I'd use the word fun, but okay.
But yeah, Shadi, you go, and then I'll try to do an even better one.
Okay. Okay, great.
Okay. So the U.S. has shown, especially through its conduct in a region like the Middle East, that hope might spring eternal, but at the end of the day, the U.S. seems structurally incapable of doing good things and of supporting its values in a way that is recognizable to Americans themselves. There's something structural in America's way of looking at the world that makes it very hard for us to be better. Capitalism is bad. Like, well, hyper-capitalism is bad. I don't know if he thinks all capitalism is bad. Clearly, he buys things and, like, enjoys life and goes to, like, very nice restaurants and probably has occasionally even been to a Michelin star restaurant. So that would suggest that he's not, like, anti-capitalist in the full sense of the term, but that he, you know, hyper-capitalist...
Shoddy. Being a monk is not the option, but okay, we can talk about that another day. Whatever.
But you enjoy the spoils of capitalism. You benefit from them, seem to be okay with them.
Bracket that.
Let's bracket this. I mean, it's a good conversation to have, and we could have that conversation. It's not a short one, though. That's the only thing.
But that because America's somewhat narrowly construed economic interests will always take precedence over commitment to democratic values because that is at the heart of American empire. It's about natural resources, economic benefit of maximizing profit. It is a little bit harder than I thought to make this case.
All right, let's give it to Danny to just...
Let's steal, man, Shadi, that America was a nation founded on certain democratic principles, and that these principles are genuinely deeply held by people, and that the United States has found itself the world hegemon, and that it should promote these principles because they are good, capital G, and that we will be able to use our military and economic hegemony eventually to do those good things.
That wasn't bad, actually.
That was pretty solid.
A lot
solid.
Of assumptions in that I disagree with, but yeah, let's say it.
All right. Well, thank you both so much. This was this is fun.
This was fun. Wow.
I like arguing with Shadi every few years.
Yeah. We have a good argumentative vibe, I think. Yeah.
You guys are great.
Yeah, I don't think either of us are easily offended.
True.
No, exactly. You have like vibe like a bit of a bickering couple sort of thing that is excellent. So, anyway, I appreciate you.
Gore Vidal and William Buckley over here.
I appreciate you both.
Thank you so much to our guests, Shadi Hamid and Daniel Bessner. We appreciate you. If you like this episode of The Disagreement, subscribe in your favorite podcast player and be a mensch and rate us and leave us a review. It'll help more listeners find our show. Subscribe to our newsletter at thedisagreement.com. You can also find us on Instagram at thedisagreementHQ. This episode was produced by Claire Tai, Greg Woodward, and Catherine Cushenberry. Additional thanks to Sophia Pasalis. Mixed by Daniel Turek. Music by Loki Alpha. Check them out on Spotify. I'm Alex Grodd. Thanks for listening. May your disagreements be healthy and highly productive.